Welcome to the Digital Academy of Behavioral Economics podcast, where we delve into the fascinating world of behavioral design. Leading our journey is Gerhard Fehr, a distinguished delegate of the Fehr Advice and Partners Board. Fehr Advice is a leading consultancy specializing in behavioral economics, creating sustainable business solutions through evidence-based insights into human behavior. Gerhard, an applied behavioral economist and behavioral designer, is renowned for his innovative approach to solving complex problems. In each episode, he invites a diverse array of guests from the fields of science and business to engage in thought-provoking conversations that bridge theory and practice. With a personal mission to inspire and foster an experimental mindset in business and politics, Gerhard creates a platform for exploration and discovery. Prepare to be enlightened and inspired.
Welcome to Uncovering Blind Spots, the podcast where we explore the hidden aspects of human behavior and decision making. I'm your host, Gerhard Fehr, and together with my co-host, Katharina Kaiser von der Rach, an experienced behavioral design manager and expert at Fehr Advice, we will dive into a fascinating topic today. The topic will be how globalization, automation, AI, and all these technological things we have seen in the past and will we see in the future, what kind of impact this will have on us as humans, on our behavior. Then we will also discuss what kind of impact it will have on the economy and our everyday life. My guest today is David Otto, professor of economics at the MIT. David is a leading authority on labor economics and will share valuable insights from his research on automation, inequality, and the changing dynamics of the workforce. But first, I would like to introduce Katharina, who is my co-host. Thank you, Katharina, for introducing yourself.
Dear David, dear Gerhard, thank you very much for introducing me. I'm going to introduce myself really quick. I'm a mother of two, working at Fehr Advice and Partners as behavioral consultant in my past and now in the Department of Finance, still highly interested in behavioral economics. And of course, the today's topic of decision making in the workforce and how we shape workplace development is highly interesting for our field as well. Therefore, I'm glad to meet you here, David, and I would love to start with a small game so that we get to know you a little bit better, if that's okay. No worries, no worries, David. It's an easy game. There's no right or wrong. I will explain it to you really quick. Basically, it's what we economists love to do. It's a reveal preferences game. Mm-hmm. I will ask you, I will shout at you couples of words. It's always two words or two options to choose from. Mm-hmm. And you will have to tell me the one you prefer best or that fits you best or resonates with you best really quick.
Okay. All right.
Okay. So let's get started. First one is confirmation bias or availability heuristic?
Confirmation bias.
Overconfidence or hindsight bias?
Hindsight bias.
Short-term gains or long-term planning?
Long-term planning.
Really? Immediate gratification or delayed reward?
Delayed reward.
Of course, you have to say that. Economic equality or individual responsibility? It's a hard one.
Yeah, I'm in favor of both. I realize I see the tension. I'm going to go with individual responsibility.
Okay. Great. Cooperation or competition?
Cooperation.
Self-perception or group identity?
Self-perception.
Personal achievement or collective well-being?
Collective well-being.
Risk aversion or loss aversion?
Loss aversion.
consistency or flexibility in decision making?
Flexibility.
Now that's one really, really shaped for you. Human machine collaboration or job displacement?
I'm going to go with cooperation there.
We hope for
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
AI, opportunity or threat?
Both. opportunity, if I had to choose one.
Great, awesome. That gives me hope. Global trade or domestic self-sufficiency?
Global trade.
Mm-hmm. Economic protectionism or free markets?
Free markets is the default, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Inflation or unemployment?
Inflation.
Rationality or bounded rationality?
Bounded.
Remote work or in-office work? PJs all day or dress up for the office?
In office.
Awesome. Work-life balance or career advancement?
Work-life balance. Not that I have it, but I would hope others have it.
Yeah.
Too much to
True.
Do.
True. Education investment or social safety nets?
Educational investment.
Great. Universal basic income or job creation programs?
Job creation, for sure.
Two more to go. We are almost there. Technological innovation or labor market protection?
Innovation.
And the last one, automation driving efficiency or eroding job quality?
Wait, I'm choosing between efficiency and eroding?
Yeah, I think it means, is automation driving efficiency or is it eroding jobs?
Oh, so I'm sorry.
That's I what see. I wanted to say.
God, it's both. I mean, I'll go with efficiency, but these are, but it's not either or.
Okay. So this has been everything, Katharina?
Yes, I'm through with my little game, but still interested on the effect of automation. We've seen from your work, I've already read it, that if it can be a gain in efficiency, but it's obviously over the last 80 years been eroding jobs Well, the job market has changed quite significantly in the last 80 years due to certain aspects of automation too.
Yes.
I'd love to hear your opinion if this is still a very driving factor or if there are other forces that are stronger at the moment.
Sure. Well, I mean, let's be clear that we're not, you know, automation has not eroded employment, right? You know, employment in industrialized countries is very high. And in fact, you know, if you count the fraction of people who are working in the paid labor force as a share of the adult population, it's risen enormously, substantially because of the entry of women into the paid labor force, where they can, you know, use their skills, their creativity, their leadership. They're not limited to the degree that they historically were. Automation technology has hugely changed the type of jobs that people do. And the skills required and the education, substantially eliminated the amount of physical work in production work, in agricultural work. Many more people do indoor work without heavy lifting. But it's a mixed bag. It certainly made, we have more of the best jobs than we have ever had. But there's also been a decline for a substantial fraction of people in the quality of jobs as we've kind of lost the middle tier of production and operative and clerical and administrative support work. And automation has been a major contributor to that, especially the age of digital computing, even more than just regular automation or mechanical automation. And then globalization has also contributed in terms of, manufacturing would have declined regardless because of enormous technological changes, but is absolutely declined more in industrialized countries because we source so much of our production, certainly of many goods, to lower wage countries, particularly China at this point.
Thanks for this answer. So, David, first of all, we had this, let's say, this word wrap. I hope this was fun for you.
Sure.
This is more or less.
It's actually a little painful because
it's you have to have.
It's not actually that fun because equality versus was it opportunity or equality versus individual responsibility? Like I believe very strongly in both of those things, but I certainly don't believe in not having individual responsibility, but I certainly believe in doing things that promote equality, especially equality of opportunity. So that's kind of painful choice.
And so you would like to quote both, but at the end, this is also not the funny part out of this game. But what we can see out of this, just that you know this, we can more or less draw and identify a little bit lifestyle, behavioral economics type, how you are.
Yeah.
And this is also what we do with a lot of clients, asking them questions. Uh-huh. And this is a test which maybe you know it was in the beginning of the 2005 or so was introduced. This is an association, implicit association test, a form of,
Right.
Where also speed about the answer is significant. So if you take longer, it's more cognitive, and if it takes a shorter time, it's more let's say intuitive. And so so you can give. And this is also Ernst wrote a paper a couple of years ago. It's the value of time. The value of time in economics is clear, but here it was times. Time is more or less an indicator how fast you respond, how valuable is your answer. So this is just for you. And so this is quite that we introduce more or less also the research topics of Ernst and all these kinds of stuff into our everyday work and also into this, let's say, format with you. So coming back to our topic, I mean, you have done so much research about this topic of the future of work, what is technology, what has automation, what is the topic of automation, what has this an impact on workers, on equality and all these kind of things. But maybe you can resonate a little bit from the starting of your career. I mean, was this always the topic you were completely interested in? Or how did this came that you entered into this topic of labor market all these kind of very interesting factors that are changing labor market and behavior of the people. Maybe you can resonate a little bit about this, how it became David Otter.
Sure. I've always been David Otter, but for as long as I can remember. But but in terms of how I got here, it's kind of a complex story that has many parts that sort of fortuitously fit together in the end. But it wasn't obvious, it's not the end, but fit together eventually. But it wasn't obvious to me how they would fit together. But I was always, on the one hand, I was a very techie kid. I was very interested in computer science and technology. And so when I was before I went to high school, I thought that's what I would do for a career. And then I became very interested in the humanities and in psychology. So in college, well, first I actually dropped out of college. I worked for a couple of years as a software developer. Then when I went back to college, I studied psychology and I was going to do a PhD in psychology. And then by the time I finished my undergraduate degree in psychology, I decided that wasn't for me either. Because although I liked the questions and I liked the sort of, the notion of helping others, I didn't feel like it felt like it was the right angle of approach for me. It wasn't the right toolkit for me. I didn't know what to do with that. So I actually started another career, and I worked for several years being the educational director at a nonprofit that did computer skills education for basically poor kids and adults in San Francisco. Worked at a Black Methodist church for several years doing this education project. So I did the technical side and the education side and a lot of the social service side. And then I decided to go back for a master's in public policy because I didn't know what else to do. And only in the process of doing that did I take my first economics class. And then it was a real revelation to me. I was like, oh, wow, this is sort of the questions I like to think about, but also a set of tools and methodology that I can that really makes sense to me because of sort of my formal technical bent. And I thought this is like, I love to think about these questions, but I never felt like I had suitable tools. So it was always like either the questions or the methods, but I couldn't have both. And economics felt
and
like.
So if you, if you say this, I mean, this is quite, I had the same, let's say, experience. So you don't like, I mean, I didn't also like the answers because I couldn't believe that these answers are the right answers. They were not. And so you have to develop an own tool or instrument setup, and this is more was more or less your motivation.
Well, but I mean, you know what? I've discovered I knew when I went back to for education what I was interested in, which I cared a lot about, sort of how technological change was affecting opportunity, power, work. But I didn't know a formal language for that. And as soon as I started to learn it, I realized, oh, this is how I can actually think and, you know, study this problem. So it was very clear to me. It's been clear to me since the day I started studying economics by accident that I wanted to be a labor economist and that questions and labor, and especially as it related to opportunity, education, skills, earnings, and its interface with technology, especially, mm-hmm. that has always been foremost, front and center in my mind. So no ambiguity once after many, many, many years of wandering around.
But I think, I mean, today we would call this a portfolio career, more or less. I mean, it was not straightforward. Yeah, it was not that. You have been eight. That there was this at the morning table. You were discussing about labor economics, and because I don't know what. And then you decided that you become economist, and then you become a professor. So it was not straightforward. So is this also, if you look, is this something which is describing you a little bit, that you are somebody who would like to experience the things?
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, I definitely, I consider myself somewhat itinerant.
Yeah.
In a kind of in a Don Quixote kind of a way, in terms of wandering around. Talking about hindsight bias, it all makes sense in retrospect, but it didn't make sense at the time.
Yeah, yeah, I know this. I know this very much. It's a very nice story, but only in hindsight.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, in hindsight. So I had no idea. And there were many traumatic changes of direction. And dropping out of college was not part of a purposive act of, expanding my career opportunities. It was desperation. The only lesson I would draw from it is that many experiences that I had professionally were incredibly formative. And I feel like as an academic, I asked different and what seem like more satisfying questions because of those experiences. So I think many people in academia at this point, not everyone should be in academia, but for those who choose to, they go a very straight and narrow path. Mm. You kind of feel like at this point you have to have this kind of gold-plated resume to get into graduate programs. And people are very cautious about deviating from that trajectory because it's so hard, actually. So it's so incredibly competitive. And I think there's a potential loss to that because you miss out on the world that you're trying to describe and understand as an academic.
Exactly.
You spend your,
so we come into the research questions and the research questions that you had in the last 30, 40 years, are completely relevant to the future and have been completely relevant to the past. So maybe, first of all, how did you came to this research question? Clearly, it's your experience, but then you have to nail it more or less. Yeah, have there been professors that were influencing you that said, "Hey, David, this is something interesting," or have you? How was this?
Well, I mean, when I started graduate school, we were just discovering this enormous rise in inequality that occurred in the United States. Data appeared with a substantial lag at that point, right? So this was, I started my graduate studies in 1996. People were just really getting to know the data that ended in kind of 1990. At that point, that's how large the latency was. And so, but people were, there was all of a sudden this, revelation that actually, the college high school earnings gap had risen enormously. The top earnings percentiles had risen enormously. Real wages had fallen for less educated workers in the United States, especially less educated men. And people were looking around for explanations. And there was a discussion, was it globalization and trade? Was it labor unions? Was it the minimum wage? And one thing people focused on was it computerization technology? But the way they focused on it didn't seem like the right angle of approach from my perspective. So people sort of said, well, is it, you know, because of word processing skills? You know, people need these valuable word processing skills and that's changing the wage structure. And, you know, is it just use of technology? And my thought was, oh, it's not really the, it's not computer skills. It's the way that computerization is changing the value of other skills. The things it's making, you know, kind of cheaper and therefore hyperabundant and not very well remunerated, and the things that it's making more valuable because it's complementary to them. And so trying to sort of articulate those ideas and, you know, kind of first as a sort of like a understanding, seeing that intuitively, and then really trying to be able to formalize and, you know, figure out what that meant and then whether there was evidence consistent with that. And so that was the initial work, especially the work I did with Frank Levy and Richard Murnane, both Frank of MIT and Dick of Harvard, and just trying to, you know, sort of set up a conceptual framework for understanding this. And that work turned out to be, I think we got something fundamentally important right at that point.
What was this?
Well, so what we said, you know, we said, instead of thinking about, you know, value of computer skills, let's ask, what is the comparative advantage of computer technology in the workplace? What does it do well? And what skills does it therefore make less necessary? And which ones does it make more valuable? And I think we came up with a very simple answer that fit the time, which is, look, computers can only carry out codified knowledge, right? They can do things that follow rules and procedures. You know, that could be, you know, calculating, that could be, you know, spell checking, that could be data retrieval, that could be repetitive physical activities in a very controlled environment, right? Not mopping floors, not washing windows, but, you know, in an assembly line. So we call these things routine tasks. Things are routine, cognitive, you know, done mentally, routine, manual, done physically. And but what we meant by routine is, one word of interpretation of routine is just like everyday boring. But what we meant by routine is following routine, following a script, right? So a non-sentient machine that couldn't improvise, couldn't problem solve, could do the job by following a script, a procedure. And something that and that meant that it was required explicit understanding. You can't write a program to do something that you don't formally understand. You can easily write a program to do a math problem or play a game of chess, but you can't write one to tell a joke because we don't understand the procedure for telling jokes, right? To create, I mean, obviously you could have it read jokes aloud, but in terms of, so we made this distinction between what we would call tacit and explicit knowledge, building on the philosopher Michael Polanyi, and said that many human capabilities, things that we do regularly, require this tacit knowledge that we don't know how to codify and program. And so those can either be, you know, abstract and creative and managerial tasks, right? Thinking of a hypothesis, making a persuasive argument, you know, leading an organization, having an insight. They could also be many things like exercising common sense. They could be, you know, cleaning up a hotel room and figuring out what's trash and what's someone's belongings left on the floor. They could be the skill and dexterity required of, you know, a carpenter or a someone in the trades, right? And all these things require a set of human capabilities that were nowhere close to automation at that time, because what computers were good for was the things that we formally understood. We didn't have a way, and we still don't have a way, to program tacit knowledge. We now have machines that can acquire tacit knowledge, but they do it the way we do it, which is experientially. Yep. Rather than based on formal training. So what artificial intelligence does to a substantial extent is it learns inductively. Yep. It learns from patterns. And so that is where we're in quite a different era. So that work that we did, I'm very proud of it. And I think it has stood the test of time, but the time has now changed. So you wouldn't, it would be a mistake to use that same set of predictions and apply them to the present. Because we now are using a different set of technologies, and that is the past. You can use the same overarching conceptual framework, of asking what set of things is the technology substitutable for, what is it complementary to, and how does that value affect the value of human expertise, which is really where the value of labor comes from. But you're going to get a different answer now than you would have got 20 or 30 years ago. And I think that that's what actually partly makes this time one of the things. I mean, this time is exciting for many reasons, but from the point of view of a labor economist, it's exciting not just to see the changes, but to try to interpret them and forecast what's going to happen. And when I say forecast, well, let me be clear. One should not confuse prediction with prophecy. Exactly. The world is not deterministic. At least human behavior and human societies are not deterministic. And there's lots of choices to be made. So one can say, what are the tendencies and the economic forces, the incentives that are created and offered by different technologies? But that doesn't tell you exactly how people will use them or what they will prioritize. Okay.
So now we are completely at the core, yeah? Because we are at the core, because I can feel it over 5,000 miles. I don't know how much it is, yeah? How this is triggering you. Because this was something, this was your research, it was something new that you developed, and you can use it, the whole principles you can use for now, and for predicting, and not in a deterministic way, but for envisaging more or less what could be the outcome of this new, let's say, learning that we have in machines, machine learning. We call it artificial intelligence, but it's a machine learning technology which is trained and then is learned by patterns. And this is more human-based. This is how we human learn in some circumstances. And so in the word wrap, what you said is it's both. And then you had to say, okay, is it good or is it bad artificial intelligence? But so now you have more, the floor is yours here, that you don't have to be so deterministic, it's one or the other. Using your framework that you developed, how can we have a more and clearer view on the effects of AI in the future?
Good. Yeah. So first of all, let's say, you know, there's almost every technology that we use creates benefits and harms, and not just at the in terms of, you know, adverse effects, but at the labor market level as well, right? Almost every technology devalues and displaces some human labor, human expertise, some valuable skill that's no longer valuable, even as it makes others more valuable. So that was true of the computer age, that, you know, it was the true of the Industrial Revolution, right? It massively devalued artisanal skills that people had invested their entire lives in. It took decades for, you know, living standards of the British workforce to start rising again after the Industrial Revolution. So AI is, and each period is distinct because we're using, you know, there's a different education level, a different set of institutions, and there's a different set of technologies, and AI will be distinct again. So I think the question, what I find useful to think about this is, you know, what makes labor valuable, particularly in an industrialized economy where, you know, pure physical, muscular strength is not rewarded very much anymore in many settings. And the answer I would say is, you know, expertise. So let me define terms. Expertise means the specific knowledge or competency to carry out some valuable task. Now, for expertise to have some economic value, right? And that, so what would that take to be? You know, baking a loaf of bread, coding an app, rewiring, the circuit breakers on a house. For it to have economic value, you need two things. One is that the thing that it enables itself is valuable to do, right? So it's got to be, you know, data science, not card tricks. And the other is that it's scarce. Not everyone can do it. Because if everyone is expert, no one is expert, right? We all drive. We all know how to drive. Therefore, driving is not, you know, simply the act of driving is not an economically especially valuable skill. If you were the only one who could do it, it would be incredibly valuable. People would pay you enormous amounts of money to transport them from place to place. So if you say, you know, the example I like to give, if you contrast the occupations of air traffic controller and crossing guard, right? These are basically the same job. They're very similar, right? The idea is to prevent collisions between vehicles and people, vehicles and one another, right? You're a traffic, either way, you're controlling traffic, whether it's air traffic or children traffic. And yet, you know, crossing guards in the United States are paid less than a quarter of what air traffic controllers are. And the reason is not because they don't do something socially valuable, or, you know, what crossing guards do isn't highly valuable. Obviously, protecting children from being run over by cars is a very important activity. But most people can be a crossing guard with no training or certification in the United States, right? An adult of sound mind and body can get that job, whereas to be an air traffic controller takes an enormous amount of, takes years in school and then thousands of hours of apprenticeship. So if all of a sudden we had a shortage of crossing guards, we could just call air traffic controllers up and tell them to go work as crossing guards. But if we had a shortage of air traffic controllers, we could not bring in the crossing guards to do that job. Right, so expertise is very important.
Just one so question expertise. If we go back to your framework, expertise, I mean, the function of, I mean, how is expertise, I mean, how do you get it? It's a matter of experience. This is one thing. Yeah. Then it's a matter of then it's a matter of formal learning.
Or informal learning.
Informal learning. Yeah. And what else? And then and how? Because in your framework you said it has to be tacit knowledge.
No. Not all expertise has to be tacit, right? A lot of the expertise that was automated by computerization was formal knowledge, right? So it was formal knowledge of, you know, how to keep books and how to spell correctly. And how to, you know, do repetitive motions on a assembly line. So, no, those things, I mean, those were valuable forms of expertise, often done by workers with, you know, high school or some college or even a college education. And all of a sudden, that expertise was no longer scarce, right? It's not that those tasks didn't need to be done. It's just they could be done more cheaply by machines. And so it doesn't actually have to be, so expertise can be displaced in a variety of ways. And it can work in a kind of, you know, so like give you another example, you know, forever, you know, London taxi drivers, right, had to, you know, spend years to master, quote, the knowledge. And then when phone-based routing came along, all of a sudden you had an app that could do what they had spent years studying to do. Now you should say, oh, shouldn't they be excited? Because now this hard thing is easy, right? So they can, you know, therefore they're you know, they can potentially be more productive. And the answer is they would be happy if it didn't mean that now anyone could do this job, right? The problem is it was now went from being an expert job to an inexpert job. And so people piled into the occupation.
This is also how we can explain Uber, for example.
Totally. Yeah. And that's, you know, London taxi drivers, you know, protested, unionized, and eventually, you know, basically found a way to keep fares higher. But the problem with making a job, so what one way in which automation sometimes affects work is they make the work simpler and therefore remove the expert component. And in some ways that makes the work more productive, but it also means if anyone can do the work, it's not going to tend to be well paid. But that's not all that automation does, right? Sometimes it actually eliminates the rote repetitive work and makes the cognitive, creative or in-depth understanding work more valuable because it removes all the bottlenecks to doing those things and allows you to focus on the thing you're really good at, right? So used to be that like actuaries, you know, people who work with statistics for companies would spend a lot of time on basically what you would call clerical and bookkeeping and data entry tasks. And now, of course, that stuff is super efficient. They focus on conceptual challenges, on making projections, right? On using better tools. So their expertise, it's not easier to be an actuary now because of computers than it used to be. You still need to understand more math and more formal reasoning, but you have better tools to do what you do. And so that expertise has become more valuable as a result of these innovations, not less valuable. So it's not, automation is in many ways a double-edged sword. The reason that the automation of middle-skilled work in the United States and many industrialized countries of office and clerical and production and operative work, why was that not so helpful to those workers? Well, many of them were displaced directly from that work. And then what did they do? They then moved into those inexpert services, right? Food service, cleaning, security, entertainment, recreation. And why? Because very little expertise was required. And so that just had the effect of pushing wages downward in those activities as well, right? So, and this is a kind of an interesting feature of expertise that expert workers can often do inexpert work, but inexpert workers can typically not do expert work. So it's kind of one way, right? You can always say, well, you know, if I can no longer work as a clerical worker, I could probably get a job in a restaurant. But you can't say if I can't keep my job in a restaurant, I can always become a lawyer, right? That's not as doesn't
and if
follow.
You apply this this principle now to AI, yeah, what we know today, and also the different circumstances that we have, more or less, that is another social environment. We are more protected than 150 years ago. Institutions are maybe work better, might work better. Let's put it like this, and so on. How is it now? Good or is it bad? I mean, the answer is clear.
Well, the answer is clear, and the answer is both. Right. You know, one should be, I think people tend to take one side of the, oh, it's all going to be great or it's all going to be terrible. And in fact, people should be simultaneously more pessimistic and more optimistic than they typically are, because there's absolutely going to be careers ended, skills displaced, stranded expertise, things that people had invested in and no longer have market value and which they built their careers around. And that could be in animation, that could be in advertising copy, that could be in certain types of software development. Simultaneously, that's the downside from a labor market perspective. Simultaneously, it's going to, first of all, enable us to do things we could never do previously.
Unbelievable, yeah.
And those themselves demand new expertise, right? So it's always the case that the new frontier of new work actually creates, or new technologies and new opportunities creates new demands for skills. It's also going to enable another set of people, typically a different set of jobs, to be more productive, because you're giving them better tools, right? You know, most tools, in fact, are not our enemies. Tools are the things that allow us to shorten the distance between intention and outcome.
So
tools are a kind of a lever for our expertise. I think what's unusual about AI relative to other technologies is it's going to have the effect of actually taking some of the most kind of judgment-based professional tasks, because professionals are basically decision makers, and making more of those things accessible to people without as much frontier training, whether that's in software development, whether that's in medical care delivery, whether that's in architecture and design, whether that's in legal services. But this is a very unusual form of animation, because normally what most automation does is it causes, people to cascade down into less expert work as they're displaced. But what is unusual about AI is that it could allow some people to cascade up or to walk up the ladder by lowering the barriers to entry, by giving them better tools. So it doesn't mean anyone could do anything with AI. That's certainly not the case. It means that, for example, a medical worker with good foundational training might be able to do more diagnostics, more procedures, because they have a better set of tools for doing it. Or someone who understands software, they don't have to know the intricacies of every programming language they use if they understand how to architect a piece of software, and then they can use AI tools to develop what they envision.
Workers in the garden, they can use tools for architecture, doing architecture work in the garden and all these kinds of things. Yeah.
Right. Or paralegals may be able to do more legal work that would previously only have been done by more senior attorneys. So I think it's a very complicated picture, and I think it's difficult to forecast with clarity what's going to happen. Certainly there'll be workers displaced. My hope is the best case scenario is it will enable some workers who are not at the frontier of education but still are appropriately trained to
become better teachers,
do harder, more valuable tasks, to do better decision making in all these professional domains, because they will have better tools to do it. And I really think AI is an amazing decision support tool. I don't think AI is an amazing decision maker.
No, it is not.
I think it's an unreliable decision maker, but it's a great decision support tool, because it can surface relevant expertise. It can take, unstructured data and tell you, what you should be looking at, what hypotheses, what things are relevant. And it can also give guardrails about, don't prescribe these two drugs together. Don't open that valve.
So, I mean, putting this together, we could say AI, if you put it in a positive way, can be a co-architect of your future. Yeah. If you put it in another way, it can, as every technology did, it can make your job redundant.
And it's going to do
it's
both.
It's going to be both.
It's going to do both. But I think, we shouldn't, one thing is we should, it's very tempting to say AI will do this or that, but it's really what people will do with AI. And there's a lot of choice. It's an incredibly flexible technology. you know, you could use it to surveil your population and filter all the things they say online in real time, right? There's countries that do that very well. But that's not because that's intrinsic to what AI does. It's because that's a choice about how to use AI. But you can also use it for improving, you know, access to medical treatment. You can use it for making education more interesting and cheaper. So there's a huge range of opportunity, and it's not clear that we have the right incentives to use it wisely. And so I think when one should be cautiously optimistic, but also suitably pessimistic simultaneously.
So, I mean, we come to the next question, and then we can ramp up. So this has to do, I mean, two things. So what I hear more or less implicitly is we have to be wise. Yeah. So there has to be a cooperation between individual, let's say, behavior and state behavior, which is called regulation. First of all, how to regulate it. And the second point here is then if we look at this, what is the real danger that you see if we don't do it wisely?
Well, so I think there are many, you know, terrible things one could do with AI. I'm going to just focus on the labor market side. and I think the... And I don't think those are the scariest parts of what one could do with AI, just to be clear, but I'm a labor economist. That's where my expertise lies. I mean, I think that there's a real rush to try to automate things, right? To say, well, we're doing it this way. Now we have a machine. Let's just do it better. Let's do it without the people. Let's do it cheaper and faster. And three issues with that. One, the least profound, is that doesn't actually often work that well. Two, even if it does, you know, you're often displacing people, and that has real social costs. But the main thing is the most profound uses of new technology are not automation. They're not taking what you were already doing and doing it a little bit faster, a little bit better, a little bit cheaper. They are when you enable new capabilities, things that you couldn't do without the technology, right? You know, you need a machine to fly. You can't fly without one. That wasn't automation, right? We didn't have long distance communications before we had the telegraph, for example. Our lives are immeasurably changed by technology because they allow us to do things that, you know, penicillin, spaceflight, mechanical transportation. So AI will prove to be profoundly important to the degree that it enables new capabilities, not simply that it allows us to automate what we're already doing. But of course, people's minds immediately go to what can I automate? Here's a new tool. What can I do that I'm already doing a little bit better with that tool, or a little bit faster, a little bit cheaper? That's fine. That's perfectly natural. But that's not where the transformative effects are going to come from. And I think the single-minded focus on how do we automate out labor, which is the first thing corporations ask, which is, you know, understandable, is A, not that productive, and B, the ratio of kind of costs to benefits is not that favorable because of the impacts it's going to have on workers, individuals, and careers.
David, my very last question about you. If you can do research now for the next 20 years and you can choose one topic you would like to go much more in where you see that it has not been, many things have not been solved, but it's the most interesting for you. What would you like to do? Where would you like to do research? And what would you like to find out?
I would like to, one, try to describe and understand how we're going to use AI and how that's going to change the way we work and what are the implications of that. But more important, even more profoundly, I'd like to figure out how to use it well and how we use AI to continue to make human labor more valuable. And that is one of the profound accomplishments of modernity, is that despite all our automation and technology, we've made labor more necessary, more important, more economically valuable than it used to be. And I think AI has the potential to both either erode that or advance that. And I think advancing it takes deliberate design choice. And so that I would, you know, if I had to focus the next 20 years on one set of questions, those would be the questions.
And I mean, what is interesting for me here, because I'm also an old man, 52, and what I figured out is that AI is a technology where it's the first technology maybe where Yes, I feel it at least, and I have read some research papers that the young, the old don't learn from the young, but we have to have some cooperative environment where both can learn from each other, because I have to my expertise more or less is to interpret the results much better than a younger. And if you do this together with the whole technology, the younger learn much faster, but you need each other. And maybe this is the first technology which is combining the young and the old, and it's not replacing the old, and it's making old workers, or like me, I'm an old worker, making more valuable, because I have expertise in interpreting the answers AI is
right. So yeah, the phrase I'd use is you have judgment, yeah. Right? And judgment is a combination of basically formal knowledge and a lot of practice, so you can extend decision making into realms where there is no known
exactly.
answer. Right? It's not clear what the right thing is to do, and that's where professional judgment comes in, and that's what humans are quite good at, but not everybody. And it takes a lot of time and training. I think AI can enable people to improve the use of judgment. I don't think it can be the judge in most cases, but it can enable people. Well, I don't want to say never, but it can be an enabler for a lot of places where we basically need to make good decisions. We have knowledge and judgment, but we're quite fallible. And this tool can help us surface the relevant information and think about the right criteria to make better decisions. And there are a lot of decisions to be made.
David, thank you very much for being here today and sharing your profound insights with us. Your research,
I
haven't mentioned this in the starting, has been very much influential on me. The Ring, I mentioned already. I am dreaming of The Ring. People who would like to know this can send me an email. To all our listeners, thank you for joining us today. We hope you have gained new ideas and inspirations to think about the role of technology, automation, AI on our environment. Stay curious and always question how your own behaviors impact the world around us. We will see us until next time. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to our exploration of behavioral design with Gerhard Fehr. We've journeyed through the nexus of science and business, gaining insights and finding inspiration from innovation. Remember, every day offers a new opportunity to apply these principles and shape a better future. Until we meet again, keep experimenting, stay curious, and drive change. To stay up to date with our latest episodes, be sure to follow the podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, consider sharing it with friends or on social media. See you in the next episode.